you've heard the phrase that we're not strangers here. We just have friends that we haven't met yet. Mm-hmm. So at this last event, I had a relative that I had. So Julie is part of our family in many ways. She's a wonderful speaker, and she's here to tell us her story. Julie, come on.
Am I talking? Can you hear me? Not yet.
Is it high as it goes?
Oh no. So maybe that?
Yeah.
How's that? No?
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, it's not on. Did I just turn it on?
It's on.
How's that? Oh my God. Like this? Can I do like a Whitney Houston? Is it okay? All right. Oh my God. How about if I talk like that? Does that work? About the same. All right. So, hi. My name is Julia, and I'm an alcoholic. And the editor in the publishing department at AAWS, Alcoholics Anonymous World Services in New York. And I want to thank Hank for asking me to speak, and all of you for welcoming me so warmly this morning. This is really an impressive meeting for me to witness. I'm just going to say it. I am not and have not been big in service. And now, with my current job, I am. So a lot of this is actually somewhat new to me. I got to the GSR level, and that was kind of, you know, where I stalled out. And I think, and now I'm catching the service bug from you guys, which is sort of interesting. I wanted to thank you for welcoming me and listening, and all of you for helping me to stay sober a day at a time. And just a little bit about my story. So my family does hail from Buffalo, and there are a substantial number of Irish Catholic drunks, many of them in recovery, or at least several of them in recovery. Another one who owned a bar here in Buffalo, not in recovery, and since passed. But I grew up in New Jersey in a big old family, and it was a wonderful family. I would say in retrospect that the ism was powerful. Workaholism, alcoholism, some other types of process, addiction kind of stuff going on. And there were seven of us, and we all had red hair. My hair used to be really red. And we looked really good on the outside. And we were falling apart from the inside, I think it's fair to say. And until there was a bit of an explosion, I don't know if explosion is the right word, but a strong expression of disorder happening in my family. People were getting sicker and sicker. And the expression of that disorder was a brother who became suicidal and suffered some other things. He is, just to say right now, he's doing great, amazing guy, blah, blah, blah. But it brought some of my family into Alcoholics Anonymous and started to change things around. I, however, was not that person who came into Alcoholics Anonymous. So in high school, I was still, I was starting to get ill, but not necessarily from alcoholism. And I did make it to college, and all of that went really well, and I presented really well. After college, I moved to New York City for about 5 minutes, and then decided I was going to move to California, which is what I did. And there, I lived in San Francisco actually for 17 years. I was a dancer and had a day job in publishing. So I was sort of copy editor for the first part of the day, and then I would go to my dance rehearsals after that. And I was living with somebody at that time who was really great to drink with. Drinking for me, I would say by late high school, college was where I really experienced the magic of alcohol. It really solved my problems unbelievably well. It really worked for me, and I think that that's what, for me, sometimes I think, like, that's, for me, what unifies me with everybody in the fellowship is just how well alcohol works for a while. I mean, it's true, right? And so for me, it was, as we say, it was the solution to my problems. And then that stops working. Then there are consequences. The consequences came first for me, well before it stopped working, if that makes any sense, and I'm hoping it does. So marriage falls apart. You know, the typical stuff, intervention in my dance company, almost fired from my job. All of these things were not caused by my alcoholism. These were just things that were happening. I was a victim, you know. That crummy husband of mine, you know, underlying all of this, for me, just speaking for me, yes, the alcoholism and the drinking and the drugging, which were part of my story, but the relentless selfishness and self-centeredness that it took me a very long time for me to see. In any event, the self-delusion on my part was extraordinarily powerful, went on for many years, well past what would have, I think, sent most people into recovery. It didn't happen for me. I was a long time in coming. But it did happen eventually. I kind of crashed and burned for a long time. I'd say 2 to 3 years, I was daily 24/7 plastic bottle of vodka under the car seat kind of drinker. That went on for a long time, shockingly. And then at one point, I realized that I really had to leave San Francisco. There were a number of reasons why I had to leave. One of them was that I'd met a guy on a plane and decided to get engaged to him. And so that was kind of great, right? Like, I got San Francisco, they were, you know, all the rents were going through the roof and my building was sold. So I basically had to leave. It was called the Ellis Act, where you could throw people out. So I had to leave, and here it was. I met this guy, and he was much better than all the other guys, you know, blah, 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 blah. He had a big job, you know? So, and he was from New Jersey. And I thought, you know, perfect. My parents are in New Jersey. It's going to get me back east, and I'm going to hang out with this guy, and I'm going to get sober. I just know it. So, you can probably guess that that's not exactly what happened. However, I did make it back to the East Coast. And mind you, I didn't even tell you this part because I am still self-centered. My parents' hearts were breaking, witnessing all of this going on to their daughter. And it's kind of emotional, this part. And but I sort of thought, well, she's going to be in New Jersey. That's going to be better, right? Ultimately, it was. So buy a house with this guy that I haven't seen the house, but we buy it, move in with him, and guess what? Really doesn't go that great. And I did start to try to get sober, accent on the try, but I was really trying. I went to, we were down the shore, as we say in Jersey, in a really, you know, kind of a nice place. I started going to meetings. Occasionally, I went to those meetings sober. Usually, I went to those meetings drunk. Had a few horrible run-ins, including, you know, a trip to the local hospital. And then would get a little more serious about not drinking. But, in fact, the fiancé at that time didn't really like that so much. And I don't fault him at all. You know, like, he met me a certain way. And I was changing that up. I was changing, you know, the dynamic. And he'd have to deal with my insanity of drinking, right? So it was sort of, you know, very schizophrenic situation for him. So ultimately, though, I did find my way into a rehab, the first one. No, that's a lie. In California, I did go to a rehab. Obviously, that didn't work. Yeah. It was a really nice place, and it did plant a little bit of a seed. In any event, in New Jersey, I did get myself to, well, no, I didn't get myself to rehab. I got into a rehab, and I learned a lot. And for me, I was sort of always an academically minded person, you know, which is like problem number one if you're an alcoholic, right? I'm really smart. How's that working? So, but anyway, I did learn a lot in that rehab. I went to a second sort of step down rehab and came out. And at that point, I really, this is 2006, and at that point, I really thought I was done. I got a job. I moved in with my parents. Things were sort of starting to go okay. But it turns out that I hadn't fully surrendered. So I started to pick up a little hiding. All of that horrible pattern restarted. And finally, it did catch up with me. It's funny, in my copy of Our Great Responsibility, I have a photograph of the last day I drank. And that day started, and my family has a place up in Maine, and it started there, and I had a 7-hour drive ahead of me with my beloved dog. I love that dog. So I got in the car that morning, and first stop, New Hampshire liquor store. Just a couple little bottles, right? Just little ones. A couple hours later, I pull off in Connecticut, find another liquor store, have a little bit of that, take a little nap. I take a little nap in the car, right? Get back on the highway with my dog, pull into another place, into a parking lot, and pass out, right? I wake up, it's dark. Still have my dog, which was like, this is like the most terrific part of the story. I have this beautiful dog, precious cargo. And finally, make it all the way home. And I distinctly remember driving down the Garden State Parkway and weaving in and out of traffic and thinking it was kind of funny. Finally get home, it must have been midnight, and forget to call my parents to let them know I've arrived. Pass out. Next morning, I wake up to these, four or five voicemails from my parents. And that was it for me. The sound of my father's voice, just completely brokenhearted, saying, "Julia, just call us," you know? The first call was, "How's it going?" You know, the second call was, "Are you lost? What's going on?" You know, and then that last call, "Just call." And at that point, I had that, for me, what is a physical embodiment of surrender, just letting go. And if I could, I would bottle that feeling and give it to people who are struggling, because I know a lot of people struggling. And when I say, you know, that word struggle is so funny to me. Bottle it and give it to those people who still think drinking is their solution, you know? But I can't. The one thing that we do have here is this message. We have each other and we have stories. So in the years after, when I finally did get sort of struck sober, and I practiced that act of surrender every morning. That was my practice. I woke up and re-embodied that feeling. I didn't even like ask for help yet. For me, it was more important to get into this notion of surrender. And then I'd been going to meetings all along. And finally, I felt like, wow, you know, I get it now. I'd wanted to get it, if that makes any sense, in my brain, but the rest of me wasn't there yet. And it took what it took. So from then on, you know, I continued in my work, and eventually, you know, and I did the steps and all that good stuff. And of course, as it does, life started to get better. And so it was sort of by happenstance that I did meet somebody who worked at GSO, and he was also had been in publishing. I hadn't realized when I met this guy, he came in after me. And his name is David R., and he's now the publishing director. So humble, this guy. I had no idea that he had been this big publishing job in the past. He had worked for many sort of distinct publishing entities and had been quite a success. But when I met him, He had just gotten sober. He's an extremely spiritual person. And he started to work at the local papyrus card store and worked his way up to manager. And I thought, oh, this guy, like, that's so great. You know, good for him. I had no idea. So anyway, we were friends. And he did end up working, getting a job at AWS. And then in the years that followed, sort of became a natural thing. You know, I talked to him about my publishing past. And so this is where I get to start my story about working on the book. That in the fall of 2016, he asked me to start work as a freelance project manager on Our Great Responsibility. At that time, the work on the book, which was then called Unity in Action, was well underway. The talks were already transcribed and being organized into a book format. The history and preface chapters were just being written. And upon reading the transcriptions for the first time, I was struck by how relevant Bill's thoughts were on AA today. More on that later, but let's just say it got me more than a little excited to work on the project. The first phase of my task was to edit, for lack of a better term, the talks themselves, and it was a bit of a balancing act, because on the one hand, the goal was to stay true to the exact verbiage as much as possible, primarily for reasons of accuracy, because as you know, we don't change Bill's words, or Bob's words, for that matter, on principle. And on the other hand, the prose had to be readable. Bill may have used notes, but he spoke colloquially and sometimes off the cuff, occasionally rambling a little and rarely missing a chance to get a laugh with a good story about an AA member, especially when that member was himself. It was exactly this style that made Bill such a great communicator, and we wanted readers to feel that they were really hearing Bill himself, that they were practically in the room with him as he told another self-deprecating tale. This was central to our mission with this book. At the same time, you can imagine that such a casual speaking style might present challenges when it's put in print. Just go to a speaker meeting and notice how many complete, grammatically correct sentences there are in a 20-minute qualification. Actually, probably don't do that. In any event, we approached it like a puzzle, employing punctuation and absolutely minimal editing in order to untangle Bill's sometimes labyrinthine sentences and to fine-tune his phrasing while doing our best to retain the rhythm of Bill's speech, his warm and welcoming tone, and his charismatic voice. Once this aspect of the project was more or less complete, it was time to visit the archives, my archives people in the house, where I got to do some shopping with Michelle and her indulgent staff. And at this point, I had become a full-time employee of AWS, and so I was able to pester them on a daily basis. And it was a real thrill to pore over the contact sheets full of slides containing images of the founders, people I'd heard and read about for years, chatting with each other, drinking coffee, sometimes seemingly unaware of the photographer. Our designer, non-alcoholic Amado Medina, my best friend, so grateful, did yeoman's work cleaning up the images, removing any tiny scratches and dust specks, and developing contrast to bring the black and white images to life. If you look through the book, you'll see how beautifully he executed this task. Once this ball was rolling, I gave the manuscripts to Spanish editor John DeStefano, non-alcoholic, and to French editor Juliet L. for translation. One translator who's also a member actually came out of retirement to work on the project. Then came writing captions and translating captions, indexing and translating the index, which was a huge project itself, followed by proofreading, second proofreading, and more proofreading in all three languages. Somewhere along the way, we had the cover designed, wrote flap copy, and then had that translated too. By the time Our Great Responsibility was printed, dozens of people had dedicated countless hours to bringing this book to life, including our own intrepid production manager, Ed Nyland, non-alcoholic, who flew to Wisconsin twice, once during a snowstorm, and literally stayed up all night to oversee the printing. At one point, he sent me photographs he'd taken of the printouts, knowing what the book was supposed to look like. And he said, this doesn't look right. I mean, it was amazing how conscientious he was. And And we were able to, you know, correct all these things with the printer's help and everything. So thank God. But the book had become our own great responsibility, and we all, alcoholic and non-alcoholic alike, felt this. Not one decision was made by a single individual. From beginning to end, the project consisted of one mini-group conscience after another. For me personally, as an alcoholic in recovery, there was much more to working on our great responsibility. First of all, these were Bill's words. Now, I'm not someone who reveres the founders as gods, but I'm absolutely certain that were it not for Bill and Bob, I'd be 6 feet under, or at best, alone in an apartment somewhere, alternating between misery and delusion. I owe my life to this program, and so do millions of others. Tackling this project was not something I could take lightly. It was a little daunting, to be honest. But if I had some trepidation at the beginning, it was quickly dispelled by Bill's approachability, that warm tone I spoke of earlier. I could feel it. After all, he was speaking to me too as a recovering alcoholic. I hadn't expected that. And as I delved into the content of the talks, as I mentioned a few moments ago, I was amazed at how true Bill's words ring today and how pertinent his insights are for me on a personal level. Throughout the talks, the twin principles of humility and, yes, responsibility recur as themes, reminding me of the work I need to do if I am to grow in understanding and effectiveness as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. For example, where am I with humility when it comes to my beliefs? Am I truly open-minded, receptive to alternative views, or do I think I know best? He says, simply because we have convictions that work very well for us, it becomes quite easy to assume that we have all of the truth. Whenever this brand of arrogance develops, we are sure to become aggressive. We demand agreement with us. We play God. It could be especially destructive for us of AA to indulge in this sort of thing. Newcomers are approaching us at the rate of tens of thousands yearly. So this is then, right? They represent almost every belief and attitude imaginable. We have atheists and agnostics. In AA, we are supposed to be bound together in the kinship of a universal suffering. Therefore, the full liberty to practice any creed or principle or therapy should be a first consideration. He even goes as far as to say, out loud, in no circumstances should we feel that Alcoholics Anonymous is the know-all and do-all of alcoholism. And what about outside the rooms? Am I holier than thou in the world at large, believing that just because I am in a spiritual program or haven't drunk in a few years, I have more on the ball than anyone else? This just struck me, this quote, as I was listening to everyone share today in the spirit of cooperation with professionals, how it's so helpful when we have that voice of humility that I heard today, you know, that attitude of like, we have a message, but we'll listen to you too, and let's, you know, collaborate, work together. Here's Bill in another timeless and timely passage. Today, we are set in the midst of a world that in the generation that Alcoholics Anonymous has existed has been characterized by a series of decisions that are products of the awful forces which are included in what the beloved psychiatrist Dr. Carl Jung called the shadow side of the human being. And indeed, our shadows have been so deeply as to near, has been so deep as to nearly approach darkness. So we must never in any spirit of condescension or superiority look upon the struggles of the world about us. After all, Bill reminds us that the founding of AA itself was not all rainbows and unicorns. Anybody who thinks that those of us who prepared that book were people running around glowing with inspiration and clothed in white robes is very, very much mistaken. I won't deny that we were very high and enthusiastic and excited, and certainly we must have been somewhat inspired, but in other respects, we acted like hell. So the book is peppered with stories like this, sort of his characteristically self-deprecatory style. But while humility is essential to our recovery and our primary purpose, it must be put into action if we are to carry the message to help the still suffering alcoholic, which is my responsibility. And where am I with that? Am I really going out of my way to extend my hand, or doing so only when the spirit moves me or when it suits me? Bill recounts the anecdote. A doctor came into the office the other day from a foreign land where AA is flourishing and is doing darn well by any estimate. He said that he'd referred a great many people to AA, but that the turnover seemed to him unnecessarily large. He had repeatedly discovered that people would say, Yeah, I went over to the AA. I went to a number of meetings, and it didn't work for me. Well, said the doctor, of course the fellow must not have tried hard enough. But it seems to me, this is Bill talking, it seems to me there were other things needed. Somehow this fellow didn't make friends over there. Now, he wasn't a psychopath. Maybe this was partly because nobody went out of their way to make friends with him. Numbers of these people came back, never having heard that Alcoholics Anonymous had 12 steps. Maybe they heard some drunk stories, saw that some people were sober. Now, sponsorship isn't just a question of a couple of visits, and now you're in the group, boys. Loving friendship is part of the sponsorship. I felt that one. Sure, I'll give my phone number when asked, and I'll sponsor the enthusiastic woman who's hit bottom, willing to go to any lengths. But what about the one who doesn't seem like she wants it enough? Isn't that just one more of my own preconceived notions? Am I compassionate and loving even when, or especially when, it doesn't come easily? It would seem to me that responsibility begins where convenience ends. Clearly, working on this book struck a few chords with me, and my hope is that you will find the same. A few months ago, I pinned this passage from page 84 of the new book, that is, to my bulletin board. As we all know, all AA progress can be reckoned in terms of just two words, humility and responsibility. Our whole spiritual development can be accurately measured by our degree of adherence to these magnificent standards. Ever-deepening humility, accompanied by an ever-greater willingness to accept and to act upon clear-cut obligations, these are truly our touchstones for all growth in the life of the Spirit. They hold up to us the very essence of right being and right doing. It is by them that we are enabled to find and to do God's will. My broader experience since joining AAWS reflects these same values of responsibility and humility. And just as our great responsibility was the product of group conscience, the work of the publishing department amounts to one group conscience after another. As the official publishing arm of AA, the publishing department is charged with a great responsibility. That is, to help members carry the message to the still suffering alcoholic in print, and today in other formats as well. The work of the department is by its nature collaborative, and as we learn in AA, humility is critical if we're going to work together effectively. Or as they say outside the rooms, there's no I in team. Every item we publish, from the group treasurer leaflet to Sharing Behind the Walls, which is the periodical that is written by and for inmates, to the forthcoming large print As Bill Sees It, which will be, we're working on a bunch of sort of reformatted large format booklets. We've had large print before, but these ones are going to be sort of up to spec, and we hope will provide greater access to those with low vision, those in our senior community, and similar. And me, who has like 12-point type, right? Anyway, all of this is made possible through close work with GSO staff and other departments, as well as what Bill called the able helpers throughout the fellowship and those non-AA friends with whom we've been blessed. And by participating in the generation and distribution of our own literature, AA members themselves, through the General Service Conference and AAWS board and committees, help us develop new ways to share our AA message. Bill W., who often called the influence of AA literature incalculable, wrote in the May 1964 issue of Grapevine, Suppose, for instance, that during the last 25 years, AA had never published any standard literature. No books, no pamphlets. We need little imagination to see that by now our message would be hopelessly garbled. Our relations with medicine and religion would have become a shambles. To alcoholics generally, we would today be a joke, and the public would have thought us a riddle. Without its literature, AA would certainly have bogged down in a welter of controversy and disunity. Currently, the publishing department shepherds the writing, editing, translation, production, warehousing, and distribution of more than 1,000 items in multiple print formats, from pocket-sized big books to large print pamphlets, as I've mentioned, for older alcoholics, and an e-book, audio, and video. Reproduce and edit literature in English, Spanish, and French with in-house editors and professional freelance translators, many of them from the U.S.-Canada General Service structure themselves, and with American Sign Language, ASL, translators and Unified English Braille translators. In addition to reprinting and updating footnotes in our various big books and 12 and 12s, each year we produce the conference final report, itself a large project, especially as we publish it in English, French, and Spanish, modify pamphlets and other literature per conference request, make changes to workbooks and guidelines per committee and staff request, and much, much more. My most intense work period begins mid-February when I receive the 700-odd pages of conference background material, which was alluded to earlier. No joke, at least 700, it could be more this year. And I oversee its translation into French and Spanish by the first week in March. Yeah, this year I hope to be wrapping up work on the souvenir book for the International Convention at the same time. Talk to me in March and see how I'm doing. As we set about preparing each literature item for printer production, collectively we strive to ensure the integrity of the message, that it not become garbled. And the publishing department does not take lightly its obligation in this regard. Our role in maintaining the integrity of the AA message can manifest in various ways. Some of them quite straightforward and relatively simple. For example, the fact that we don't change Bill's words, as I mentioned earlier. Likewise, we stay consistent with AA terminology and usage, not only in English, but also in French and Spanish, in order to ensure the non-garbledness of the message in those languages as well. In fact, in recent years, the publishing department has sought to improve consistency and clarity across the board, especially in translations, and has begun revising much of our literature. As I speak, the Spanish translations of two of the AA history texts are undergoing revision. And for the conference background translation project, I'm fortunate to have three team leads, all of them professional translators as well as AA members, with our peculiar lingo and ways of speaking. It's so, last year when I did this, this is actually my third year doing the conference translation. The variations on, sharing the message, how these things get translated by non-members is really fascinating. And it's only, I think, through doing that that I realized how peculiar we are with our jargon. Specific, I should say, not peculiar. This directive to protect the integrity of AA's message has required more subtle and complex approaches over time, especially as we seek to reflect the broadest AA experience possible. After all, inclusivity and access to AA are ever-present imperatives. Indeed, they are our responsibility as alcoholics. We need always humbly ask ourselves, to whom have we not carried the message? And sometimes we need to ask ourselves, how clearly have we carried the message? As some of you may know, November and December saw publication of new American Sign Language translations of the Big Book and the 12 and 12, respectively. That was the press release that Lila was showing you earlier, was for those publications. And this story, I think, beautifully demonstrates how AA members and our friends carry the message with care. The end result of several years of work, this large project began several years back when it was communicated to the treatment and accessibilities assignment that the ASL translation of the Big Book did not reflect then current usage within the deaf community. In essence, the message was garbled to today's membership. A GSO committee was formed to reach out for feedback from deaf members of the sober community in upstate New York, Minnesota, Texas, and on the West Coast. Ultimately, these AA members who are deaf helped select the trio of translators who worked on the new video. The three translators worked together over the course of 3 months, figuring out what to sign and how to sign it, much of the process directed by an individual who coaches signers for meetings. The video itself was shot on the first floor of 475 Riverside Drive, which is where we all work. I was lucky enough to sit in on one of the shoots and to witness the dedication and, yes, humility of these non-AAs as they worked tirelessly to convey our program of action with clarity and conviction. Afterward, deaf AA members were invited to review portions of the film to make sure it reflected accurately the spirit and meaning of the two central AA texts. Then came months in post-production, the editing and proofing of the subtitles, etc. The new ASL Big Book is over 6.5 hours long. The new 12 and 12 is over 5. Do visit the website to watch the press release in ASL. I highly recommend it to get a taste and then view a page or two, which is also online. If you're interested, there's a story about the whole process in the winter issue of Box 459. And while I'm mentioning Box 459, that is something that as a GSR you can receive. And it is, it's actually a really, I think, underutilized resource, something produced at GSO, and really tells you what's going on, what we're up to, what folks around the country, what you guys are up to. It's just a wonderful sort of resource for shared experience and what's current. Speaking of these languages, just outside the editorial corner where I sit can be found the individuals who handle licensing and translation of AA literature beyond our structures, French and Spanish. Now experiencing a surge in translations by local committees worldwide, AA literature is today available in more than 100 languages, including our main text, the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, which is currently available in 71 languages and counting, with more than 20 new or revised translations in the works in languages that I honestly, some of them I had not heard of. It's fascinating and very inspiring. Also within the publishing department are seasoned professionals managing inventory, order entry, customer service, shipping, tasks needed to handle the thousands of orders every year. And those of you familiar with recent conference advisory actions know that another collaborative publishing effort is currently underway, the revision of the AA service manual, to which many of you are getting your first introduction. This multi-phase project has thus far involved face-to-face meetings, conference calls, and input from stakeholders ranging from former and current staff to rotated delegates to GSRs new to service. At the moment, I'm gathering responses to a survey we sent out with our first draft of the revised and redesigned manual, and a later draft will be discussed at the 70th General Service Conference. So there's lots more, and there's lots more that I haven't listed here that goes on a daily basis at the GSO. So while much of my day might be spent sort of figuring out if the translator actually, you know, translated the conference committee on trustees and didn't mistake it with the trustees committee on conference, which happens a lot. Much of my day is really spent working with others in this sort of group conscience way on so many of our projects. But I have to tell you the coolest thing, personally, about working there is obviously, you know, I'm working on the literature minute by minute. And sometimes it feels like, gee whiz, like I get to a meeting and it's a big book meeting. It's like, oh, like, and I go and I look at the copyright page. Gee, what printing is, you know, sometimes I can get a little carried away. The most important reminders I get are when I'm sitting at my desk in the office and a group comes around and they're visiting from wherever, someplace around the world. For some reason, we get a lot of people from Iceland. And wherever they're from, the feeling is the same. It's this deep sense of recognition, the sense that I know you, you know me. It is magic. It is nothing short of magic. And to walk in here this morning and feel that, as Hank said, you know, friends we haven't met yet or something, right? That is just an extraordinary gift, and I'm so grateful to be working where I work. I have to say I'm probably more grateful to be sober in the first place, and I'm grateful to all of you for welcoming me so warmly. And making me a little nervous with high expectations. But anyway, that's all I really had to say today. I have trouble sometimes with doing what a friend of mine calls landing the plane, you know, when I do a share, which I just love. Having trouble landing the plane on this chair. But thank you again, and thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. I love you all. Thanks.